Hello, and welcome to this Microsoft TechNet session on authenticating user requests in Microsoft Internet Information Services 6.0 and ASP.NET 2.0. Authentication is a key step in creating and deploying your websites and applications on IIS, and you need a solid understanding of it to make intelligent choices about which authentication types you use. Let's start this session by going into more detail on what we'll be covering. Today we're presenting an overview of authentication in IIS 6.0. We'll talk about all methods of authentication available in IIS 6 and go into enough detail so that you can get a solid understanding of each type. To do that, we'll touch on the following points. We'll define what authentication is and how it differs from authorization. We'll also talk about why authentication is important for you as a web developer and IT pro. We'll introduce the different authentication types that you can use with IIS 6.0 and how IIS 6.0 determines which one to use when a user request arrives at the server. Then we'll go over each authentication type in detail, from how to configure each one to how each one works when a request arrives at the IIS 6.0 server. Finally, we'll cover ASP.NET 2.0 forms authentication, which is a bit different from IIS 6.0 authentication. It's different because it relies on configuration tasks you must perform for ASP.NET and a few simple programming steps, which we'll go over in a demonstration. As with most TechNet sessions, some prior experience of Microsoft technologies or similar technologies is always helpful. Next is a brief overview of what would be helpful, but not essential, for this session. As we go through today's session, you will hear various Microsoft acronyms and terminology. While we will explain all new terms related to today's session, there are some general terms from the industry or from other versions of Microsoft products that we may not spend time on. To help you out, we have listed the areas that it may be helpful to be familiar with, either prior to this session or to reference afterwards. It would be helpful to have some IT administration experience with Microsoft Windows Server 2003, Internet Information Services 6.0, and ASP.NET 1.1 or 2.0. To cover the topics mentioned and keep the session flow going, we have divided the session up into the following agenda items. To start, we'll discuss the basics of authentication in Microsoft Internet Information Services 6.0. We'll begin by identifying the authentication types that IIS 6.0 supports, and then go into how IIS determines which type to use when a user request arrives at the server. Then we'll take an in-depth look at each of the authentication types, including Anonymous, Basic, Digest, and Windows Integrated. We'll go over how each type deals with an incoming request for secured resources and discuss the strengths and weaknesses of each one. We'll also see demonstrations on how IIS sub-authentication works and how easy it is to decrypt basic authentication credentials sent over an HTTP connection. Finally, we'll cover ASP.NET Forms authentication, which not only requires you to perform configuration tasks, but also may require a bit of development work to make it function correctly. We'll have a demo on how to authenticate a user into an ASP.NET application. Before we get started with the main presentation, let's go over the differences between authentication and authorization. The first issue we're going to discuss today are the differences between authentication and authorization. Without a solid understanding of what these two terms refer to, you'll be at a loss sometimes when you're troubleshooting problems with your applications on IIS 6.0. Authentication is the process that the web server goes through to determine who a web request is coming from. The two default authentication mechanisms used by IIS 6 are Anonymous Access and Windows Integrated. Anonymous Access is based on Requests for Comments, or RFC, 2617, the RFC for HTTP. This dictates that web servers accept requests from clients in an anonymous format. For certain portions of our websites, we may decide to limit access and, therefore, require another form of authentication. Regardless of that decision, however, the web server will always be able to identify where the request is coming from and what type of authentication is required for the requested resource. The first time you receive a request for a particular page or other resource on your site, IIS 6.0 assumes that the request is anonymous. If the resource requires some other form of authentication, IIS will reject the request and send to the client browser what the supported authentication types are for that resource. Authorization, in contrast, is not the process of determining who the request is coming from, but whether you can access the resource you are requesting. The first step in this process is to find out who the request is coming from. In other words, the first step in authorization is the authentication process. The second step the web server takes is to determine what you have access to. The way it does that is to attempt to access the URL you requested using the token created in the authentication step. If you have permissions to the URL, you will be able to view the resource associated with it. If you don't have permission to the URL, the web server will return an error that says access is denied. Now, when you're troubleshooting your application, it's important that you know the HTTP error code generated by problems in either authentication or authorization. 401.1 errors occur when authentication fails because the client browser isn't supplying a valid username and/or password to IIS. On the other hand, 401.3 errors occur when the access control list, or ACL, for the requested resource does not allow access for the authenticated token. Let's return to our agenda for a moment. We'll now look at the basics of authentication in IIS 6.0, which covers the supported authentication types and the steps IIS takes to authenticate a user when a request arrives. Let's quickly review the different authentication types supported by IIS 6.0. IIS 6.0 supports several modes of authentication. You'll decide what is best for your situation based on who will view your website or application, whether you need to authenticate users, and the technologies you are using to create and support your site. The first type is anonymous access, which is how most internet users today access web content. Anonymous access is the default authentication type in IIS 6.0, and it doesn't require the browser to send credentials, a username, and password to the server to access the content for a request. There's also basic authentication, another popular and common authentication mechanism for accessing web content. With basic authentication, a browser sends a clear text username and password to the server to verify the identity of the user generating the web request. Digest and advanced digest authentication are both a little more complex, and they provide an extra level of security over basic authentication. Then there's Windows integrated authentication. Windows integrated authentication is composed of two authentication mechanisms, Kerberos and NTLM. This option is well suited for an intranet website protected by a firewall, but may not be your best choice for internet websites. Next is Microsoft Passport, which offers single sign-on functionality. IIS 6.0 is the first version to directly support this. Finally, there is ASP.NET Forms Authentication, which is not fully dependent upon IIS for performing authentication. You can only use this mechanism with ASP.NET applications. Also, it not only requires configuration in the IIS 6.0 manager, but also certain ASP.NET configuration tasks and some development steps to ensure it works correctly. Now that we've briefly covered the types of authentication that IIS 6.0 supports, let's take a look at how IIS responds when a user request arrives. So let's get a feel for what authentication steps IIS 6.0 takes when a user request arrives. First of all, we have the incoming request that arrives at the server core, let's say for the page default.htm. After the IIS server core receives the request, the server core forwards the request to the anonymous authentication provider by looking up the URL for the file in the configuration file. IIS builds the path, and the path alone determines whether anonymous authentication is enabled. If anonymous authentication is enabled, IIS will continue processing the request by providing the path and the user's token to the authorization manager. In just a few minutes, we'll take a more detailed look at what IIS does when anonymous authentication is enabled and how you can break anonymous access as well. If anonymous access is not enabled for that path, IIS will pass the path to each of the other authentication providers to determine if that authentication provider has been enabled for the URL. This is so we can build a www-authenticate header to send to the client so that it can know what authentication types are enabled for our page. The client can then determine which type is best for it to use. Now that we understand a little of how IIS 6.0 works to authenticate incoming requests, let's revisit our agenda. We'll now take a closer look at each of our authentication types and how they work on IIS 6.0. We'll include special steps you have to take to configure some of the authentication types and show you demos on how many of them are used. Let's start with anonymous access. When you use anonymous authentication with IIS 6.0, you're essentially not using authentication at all. Let's take a closer look. When the browser client sends a request for a page hosted by IIS, it doesn't send any authentication credentials at all. Let's say the browser requests default.htm. When IIS receives this request from the browser, it assigns a built-in account named the IUSR computer name account, with computer name equal to the name of the server computer, to the request. IIS then uses this account and the password that goes with it to check whether the default.htm page is enabled for anonymous authentication. If the page is enabled for anonymous authentication, IIS will grab its content and return it to the requesting browser. However, if the default.htm page is not enabled for anonymous authentication, and we mentioned this briefly already, IIS will compose a www-authenticate header that contains the authentication methods the page is configured for and return it to the browser in a 401 error code response. So this looks simple and, in theory, it is. However, there are a few complications in anonymous authentication that we need to cover. Let's start by going over the IUSR account. By default, anonymous authentication is performed by a built-in account in IIS. The account is named IUSR computer name, with computer name being the name of the server on which IIS is running. So if your server name is CA_main, the anonymous account name would be IUSR_CA_main. Many IT pros confuse this account with the IWAM account, which is the Web Access Manager account. We've deprecated IWAM in IIS 6.0, but even in earlier versions of IIS, the IWAM account had nothing to do with authentication. So this default account, IUSR_computer_name, is the account IIS 6.0 authenticates to the requested content. There are two different ways that IIS does this. First, this account provides uninhibited access to resources on the Windows system. This means that the account doesn't need any special privileges. It isn't assigned a user token or anything like that. It is a local user, so you can delete it. If you do delete it, IIS will recreate it when you perform a server restart. This mechanism is simply so that you won't break your IIS install and won't put yourself in a situation that you can't recover from. You can disable the IUSR_computername account, and you can read about how to do that in a knowledge base article on support.microsoft.com. The IUSR_computername account is created when you install IIS 6.0 and is automatically added to the server system's guests group. Since it's added to that group, the account inherits all the permissions that are granted to guests. This is why the guests group has been granted limited privileges by default. The anonymous account is also used by the Microsoft FTP server, so it isn't just used by the World Wide Web service. Our next point, however, is key, and many people don't realize how complex anonymous authentication can be. This lack of understanding is why many people are surprised when anonymous authentication breaks. Understanding IIS sub-authentication is the key to understanding IIS 4.0, 5.0, and now 6.0. Using IIS sub-authentication is the default in IIS 4 and 5, and most of our customers don't even know that this functionality exists. So let's get a little more specific about what IIS sub-authentication is and what it does. In the simplest of terms, if you've clicked the checkbox in the Internet Manager on IIS 4.0 or 5.0 that says allow IIS to control password, you've enabled IIS sub-authentication. So what does this really mean? The component that contains the sub-authentication functionality is IIS_SUBA.dll. This is important for you to know because in IIS 6.0 you'll have to enable this component. It isn't done for you by default. We'll talk about why this was disabled in IIS 6.0 in just a couple of seconds, but you're probably wondering what the IIS_SUBA component is for. The reason it exists is to avoid domain password synchronization issues. As administrators who are running web servers, especially on corporate intranets where the servers are members of domains, it's rather painful to be required to update the password of an anonymous account every 3 months, or whatever the specified period of time is required by the domain. Not only is doing this impractical, frequently the domain does not store the correct username for the server. So in this case, we needed to create a functionality that wouldn't break and that wasn't tied to the account password stored in the IIS metabase. The IIS team did this by creating this IIS_SUBA component. There are several security breaches that this functionality opens up, and these are the reasons that it was disabled for IIS 6.0. It must be run in process. This wasn't a problem in IIS 4 and 5. In fact, it ran in INET info just like every worker process did in those versions. But in IIS 6.0, the worker processes have been separated out from the INET info where the metabase runs. They each run in their own worker process, W3WP. To enable sub-authentication in IIS 6.0, we have to emulate INET info in each worker process, which means that IIS_SUBA needs to be run as the local system account. This is an elevated privilege account, and you won't always want these worker processes granted that level of trust. Again, sub-authentication was enabled in the user interface in IIS 4 and 5, but since it's been deprecated in IIS 6, we've made enabling it a little bit of a challenge. If you decide to use sub-authentication in IIS 6.0, there are a few steps that you need to take, and none of them are in the IIS Internet Manager user interface. The first step you'll need to take is to register the iissuba.dll from the command line using the runDLL32 utility. This command is case sensitive, so you'll want to enter it carefully. Next, you'll have to set your application pools to run all, and we mean all, worker processes on the server that use anonymous authentication to run as the local system. And last but not least, you'll have to set the anonymous password sync property in the IIS60 metabase to true. You can set this at the virtual directory or site level, but if you want this to be applied to all sites, you'll edit the metabase at the W3SVC level. We'll go into all the details of how you can do this in our first demo in a few minutes. Now let's take a look at how to disable IIS sub-authentication. To disable sub-authentication after you've enabled it in IIS 6 takes a straightforward couple of steps. First of all, just like enabling, you'll need to use the runDLL32 utility, but this time you'll unregister the iissuba.dll component. Then you'll set the anonymous password sync property to false in the metabase. You're simply undoing two of the steps you took to enable sub-authentication. Let's take a look at some of the metabase properties you need to edit if you decide not to use sub-authentication but still want to use anonymous authentication. If you're not using IIS sub-authentication, there are two secure metabase properties that you need to know about. The first is the anonymous username property, which specifies the user account that we're going to use to log on for anonymous authentication when IIS receives an anonymous request. It takes a string that contains the IUSR_computername value that we discussed a little bit ago. The second is the anonymous userpass property, which contains the string that represents the password to use for anonymous requests when you're not using sub-authentication. After you set these metabase properties, the token for the anonymous user account is generated when you start the W3SVC service on IIS. This, of course, is if everything is working as we expect it to. An important thing to note is that both of these properties must be set to the values used for sub-authentication before you disable sub-authentication. This means that if you have enabled sub-authentication in IIS 6.0 and then you want to disable it, before you do that you must synchronize these two properties to those that were last being used by the sub-authentication feature. If you don't, you'll get a 401.1 error. To troubleshoot this, you can track whether anonymous authentication has failed using the Event Viewer Security Log. You can customize the IUSR account by creating a completely new account and assigning the new account's name to the anonymous username metabase property. You can also customize this at the website or the virtual directory level. You can run each site with its own unique account, or each application can have a unique anonymous account. IIS does not require you to maintain the iUser account as the only anonymous account that your server uses. Let's move on to our first demo, which shows us how to use IIS 6.0 sub-authentication. First, we're going to enable IIS 6.0 sub-authentication for a website and then show you a request coming into IIS that uses it. After that, we'll show you how you can break sub-authentication, which is why it was deprecated in IIS 6.0. In this demonstration, we start by looking at some of the scripts that we are using to set up sub-authentication on IIS 6.0. We are going to use runDLL32 to register sub-authentication. Let's go ahead and do that now. We go to the Windows/System32 directory and then return to our script file and copy our command for registering sub-authentication. Then we'll paste it into the command prompt. Unfortunately, you won't get any response from the system here that tells you whether the registration was successful or not. The only way you can find out is by going through with the next step. To do that, we need to go to the IIS admin scripts directory and enable IIS sub-authentication now. We use the ADS util tool to do this, so we copy it from our script file and then paste it on the command line. We've set the anonymous password sync metabase property to true, and we should have IIS sub-authentication enabled for this version of IIS. Now let's look at the IIS manager. IT pros often ask us whether they can set the anonymous password sync property in the IIS manager. The answer is no. To set it for the default website, we go under Properties and then click Directory Security. When we get to the Authentication Methods page, we enable Anonymous Access, which is a requirement. Without doing that, IIS would ignore the sub-authentication settings that we have already changed. Now, if the username and password in the metabase are correct, you will be able to access your content on the server. All web pages will come up correctly using the credentials we have set, so we can access content using the credentials that sub-authentication has set up for us. Now let's go ahead and see how we can break IIS sub-authentication, which is the reason that it's deprecated in IIS 6.0. We'll go back to the IIS manager and into the property pages. First, we'll make sure that the default website is running under the default application pool, and then change the application pool to run under an identity of local system. This is a security risk, but we'll click Yes in response to the warning dialog box. In a real-world situation, you can open up your server to a world of security issues if you do this, so be very careful. Now, when we refresh the page we requested earlier, we still get the page. But what happens when we change the password in the metabase as well as on the user account itself? Let's begin by changing the password for the user account. We're using Active Directory because we have our server set up as a domain controller. If you have your server set up as standalone or a member of a domain, you'll do this in local users and groups on the computer management tool. We go through and enter our new password, then we confirm it. Click OK, and click OK again, and there, we have just changed the user account password for the IIS machine account. The password we just changed and the one stored in the metabase are now going to be different. But if we go into adsutil.vbs in Notepad, we can quickly find out what the password is set to in the metabase. We search for a function named isSecureProperty. We enter isSecureProperty equals false, and then exit function. And when we save this, it will no longer protect the password when we ask for it. Now we use the ADSUtil tool to get the anonymous user pass property. Now this information is what IIS sees as being in the actual metabase. Don't forget, we just changed that value for the user account, so this is no longer accurate. All we have to do is add this code to the ADSUtil.vbs file to get the password as it's stored in the metabase. But this isn't really a security concern. You can only do this as an administrator, and as an administrator, there are several other things you can do that cause much higher security risks. For you, this is an easy way to troubleshoot if you have a username password synchronization problem. And in this case, we do have that problem between the user account password and the value stored for it in the metabase. Now, let's recycle the application pool. We're using the default app pool, so we only need to enter that name on this command. You can also use the PID of the app pool associated with the application you're running. With the application pool recycled, this means that IIS will clear all caches and anything else that is associated with the request we made earlier. Let's go into the user interface and reset the password for the account there as well. We'll set it to one which we know is not correct. And then we click OK once, and click OK again. Now, since we've already enabled IIS sub-authentication, we can browse to the page we looked at earlier, even though the password we entered is incorrect. You would probably expect that we would not be able to access this page, but we can. All we need to do to change this behaviour is to undo what we did just a bit ago. We set the anonymous password sync property to false in the metabase. Again, we have to close Internet Explorer. Then we go ahead and recycle the default application pool. Now, when we browse to our file again, we find that the browser returns a 401.1 error, unauthorized access due to invalid credentials. All we have to do is set anonymous password sync back to true and sub-authentication would work again. We don't have to have the correct password. All we need is the user account that already exists on the system. It uses something called a TCB privilege, which stands for Trusted Computing Base. This is a high-level permission granted to any process that is running as local system. The local system processes do not necessarily need a password to log on the user and successfully be authenticated. That is how sub-authentication works and why the IIS team disabled it for IIS 6.0. Now let's take a look at basic authentication. Basic authentication is widely used on the internet. That's because it has wide browser support and it is simple to use. So let's go through how basic authentication handles an incoming request. This scenario begins just as anonymous authentication begins, with the browser client sending an anonymous request for a page, let's say default.htm. IIS then checks whether the default.htm page is enabled for anonymous authentication. IIS determines that default.htm is set to basic authentication and composes a www-authenticate header that indicates default.htm requires basic authentication. It then sends the header to the browser in a 401.1 HTTP error. The browser will then prompt the user for a username and password. When the user has entered his or her credentials, the browser Base64 encodes them and sends them back to IIS. Once IIS authenticates the user and verifies that he or she is authorized to view default.htm, the page's content is sent to the browser. Now that we know the process by which basic authentication works, let's take a look at some of its advantages. There are a number of advantages for you when you choose basic authentication. First of all, basic authentication is backed by the RFC for HTTP, RFC 2617. This RFC defines the basic and digest authentication schemes. Basic also supports proxies, and it has wide browser support. Netscape, Mozilla, Safari, and Internet Explorer all support basic authentication. Finally, It's an excellent authentication option when you combine it with the Secure Sockets Layers SSL. This is the way to go. If you're going to use basic authentication, go ahead and use an encryption technology with it that allows you to protect user credentials as they are sent from the browser to the server. SSL will add extra encryption and make it difficult for a hacker who is trying to read passwords over your HTTP connection to get the usernames and passwords. Now let's talk about the disadvantages of using basic authentication. While there are many advantages to using basic authentication, there are a number of caveats that you need to know about as well. As we mentioned before, the browser uses the Base64 format to encode the password. This means that you cannot get a network monitor trace to see the content of the request and get the user's password. However, you do have access to it in Base64 format. We'll see in just a minute in our next demo how easy it is for a user to decode this password, which is a big reason that basic authentication is not considered secure. This is why many people refer to basic authentication as clear text authentication. Because of this clear text issue, you must use basic authentication with Secure Sockets Layer, or SSL. The default in basic authentication is that the connection between your browser and IIS is not secured, so you have to perform the extra steps of setting up SSL for your site or application, which adds a layer of complexity to setting up basic authentication. In addition, if both basic and Windows integrated authentication are enabled for a path in IIS, Internet Explorer prefers to use Windows integrated authentication because it is considered a more secure protocol. This isn't always a good scenario because many of our customers do not realize that they have Windows integrated authentication enabled along with basic authentication. The last disadvantage is that the encoded password is sent directly over the open HTTP connection between the browser and IIS. This makes it fairly easy for anyone who wants to decrypt the password and steal information that's supposed to be secure. Now we'll go through a demo that will show just how easy it is to decode that encrypted password. We're going to show you how easy it is to decode basic authentication credentials on a simple system. We'll show you how a user can grab the basic credentials off of the HTTP connection and then go to a website that decodes Base64 encodings. Before you know it, you'll see the administrator name and password for the computer we're running the demo on. Let's close a couple of windows we opened in our last demonstration. Now we can switch to the IIS manager, disable anonymous authentication, and then enable basic authentication. Again, we are working with Active Directory, so we need to enter a domain where our user account is stored for this demo. We type contoso.com and click OK. Now that we have enabled basic authentication, we want to reiterate that it's a simple method of obtaining a username and password from an incoming request. We're ready to use our wfetch tool to show you how easy it is to gather basic credentials over an HTTP connection. So let's test a request. We will set the authentication type to basic. But before we enter the credentials, let's set up a log file so that we can easily capture the output from wfetch. We're going to call that log file wfetch.log, and it will show up on the desktop when we run the tool. We enter the actual credentials that we created in Active Directory, and then we click Go. And the log output window gives us information about the request. We're looking for the authorization basic header that contains the Base64 encoding of the username and password. When we open the log file and look up the authorization basic header, we'll see our Base64 encoded credentials. Now, you may say to yourself, this doesn't look like anything you can use to hack a password with, but we'll use the base 64 encoding and decoding tool we mentioned earlier to show you how easy this is to decode. We open a command prompt and navigate to our demo tools directory. Keep in mind here that you can only grab these credentials if you're not using Secure Sockets Layer, or SSL, on the wire with basic authentication. Here we are at the tool, base 64 decode, and then we paste in our encoded credentials. And there you have it, the username and password we entered for the user. That's how easy it is to decode a basic authentication header, and is why we say you're essentially sending the credentials in clear text when you use basic authentication. It doesn't take a lot of work. It probably took us less than 2 minutes to come up with the username and password here. You don't even need to use this little tool. You can perform a web search for base64 decoders and you'll find websites that have similar tools that you just plug in the encoded credentials and decode them in seconds. Now, it isn't quite this easy because we already knew the password, but if you turn on a network monitor trace, you can find this exact same information being sent from the server to the client, unless you use SSL, as we mentioned just a second ago. This is why you should never, and we mean never, use basic authentication without using SSL with it. If you enable SSL on the connection between the client and the server, the username and password will remain encrypted until they reach the server. Only after the server receives the credentials will it decrypt them. Next, we'll take a look at digest authentication. So, what is digest authentication? Digest authentication is defined in RFC 2617, the same RFC that defines basic authentication, and it's available only in IIS 5.0 and 6.0. The process of digest authentication is similar to basic authentication, in theory, with an extra couple of complexities thrown in. We'll step through this process in just a minute or two. Instead of sending the username and password in base64 format, the browser hashes the username and password using the message digest algorithm, MD5, and sends the hash value to IIS. One of the limitations of digest authentication is that it requires IIS sub-authentication, the functionality we discussed a bit earlier. Remember, this requires registering the IIS SUBA DLL and running all processes that use digest authentication as local system, a group that has elevated privileges. Digest authentication also requires Active Directory, a big overhead by itself. We are not trying to deter you from using digest authentication, but you need to understand the complexities of what you're taking on if you decide to. With digest authentication, we also store the password in Active Directory using reversible encryption. This means that you have to go to the Active Directory user account to allow users to store their passwords there so that we can later do a comparison against incoming passwords. We'll show that in just a few minutes. Let's take a quick look at how digest authentication works when a request comes in. Digest authentication begins in the same way all other authentication schemes do, with a browser sending a request for anonymous access to a file on IIS, which, for our purposes here, we'll call default.htm. IIS denies the request and sends the browser a 401.1 error code that contains a www-authenticate header that indicates that digest authentication is being used and includes the Active Directory realm name. The browser then prompts the user for credentials, username and password, and combines these credentials with the name of the realm to create an MD5 hash. The browser then resubmits the request for the file from the server running IIS, this time sending the MD5 hash. The server running IIS receives the hash and sends the client's hash to the domain controller for verification. The domain controller informs the server running IIS of the authentication results. If the client is authenticated, IIS sends the requested document or data to the client. So, with a basic understanding of Digest Authentication, let's talk a little about its cousin, Advanced Digest Authentication. It can be a little confusing in IIS 6.0 because you have Digest and Advanced Digest Authentication available to you. What are the differences? Well, first, the IIS team made the fixes to Digest Authentication to make it completely RFC 2617 compliant. Some of the other fixes had to do with measuring up to fully meet the security concerns present in basic authentication. Advanced Digest Authentication doesn't rely on SSL for security, and it doesn't send the full username and password over an open HTTP connection. Instead, it pre-compiles a password hash for the username when that user is created in Active Directory. This hash is protected and can only be accessed by some of the privileged accounts that are used to look up and authenticate users on the Windows system. Even domain administrators do not have access to this hash. It does require that your IIS server be running in a Windows Server 2003 Active Directory forest. If it is not, Advanced Digest Authentication will fail. That means you cannot run in mixed mode or any other modes in Active Directory. And, as we mentioned earlier, Advanced Digest Authentication is only available on Windows Server 2003 and IIS 6.0. So how then do we tell which version of Digest Authentication we're running on IIS 6.0? We get a lot of questions about that, including, if we added Advanced Digest, why did we keep Digest? The main reason is that we want to have legacy support for those of you who are running Digest with your web applications. We don't want to force you to upgrade to another technology when Digest may have been working just fine for you. The way IIS determines which Digest authentication method you're using is based on the type of install you used, clean or upgrade. You can double check this by looking for the Use Digest SSP property in the metabase. If you performed a clean install of Windows Server 2003 and IIS 6.0, this metabase property will not exist. If you performed an upgrade from Windows 2000 Server and IIS 5.0, this property will exist. Know that if you performed an upgrade and you've been using Digest Authentication, you'll have to re-enable IIS sub-authentication for Digest to work. Now let's run through a demo of how Digest Authentication works. We want to show you how to set up Digest Authentication so that it will work. We won't be using Advanced Digest because we want to show you Digest reliance on IIS sub-authentication. We'll also authenticate a request and, in doing so, show Digest reliance on IIS sub-authentication. We saw a little earlier how the sub-authentication system was registered with run.dll32, ISSSUBA.dll, and register.IIS.SUBA. We have a sample website set up here named DigestAuth, and it has Digest Authentication set up for it only. Let's go into the IIS Manager so that we can show you the user interface. We have Digest Authentication enabled and have selected an Active Directory realm in which the user account resides. We will authenticate against this store. We are also using a Digest application pool, and this pool is running under the identity of the local system. These settings are important for you to know because they are required by Digest Authentication. We also assigned the website to run under the Digest pool. We'll go ahead and make a request to this site. we are prompted for our username and password. This user interface says the secure website requires you to log in. It is a little different from the user interface you see with basic authentication. With the credentials we entered, authentication fails, and we still see our logon form generated by Digest Authentication. Let's fix that. What we need to do here is verify that we have registered IIS sub-authentication. We'll go to the Windows System 32 directory and run the command we used in the sub-authentication demo earlier. Run DLL32, IISSUBA.dll, then we'll put in the comma and register IISSUBA. Again, we get no response from the system, so we just have to assume that we were successful. Now we'll need to recycle the application, so we'll get the PID for the digest pool. Then we'll recycle it using IISApp/P, the PID of the pool, and /R. The application pool has been recycled, so we can close our command prompt window. Next, we need to go into Active Directory to check that our actual user does exist. It is named Web User. We also need to make sure that we have the correct password set for the user, so we'll enter it here. Then we confirm it and click OK. Now, some of you may be wondering about the reversible encryption that we mentioned before. If you go into the User Object Properties and then to the Account tab and look in Account Options, you'll see the checkbox for storing the password with reversible encryption. Now, this is a requirement for Digest Authentication to work, so we'll select that. If we didn't, Digest wouldn't work at all. What we're going to do now is make a request to our site again. We request the variables ASPX page, and here we have it. This page has the authorization header, and it tells us that the authentication type is Digest. It also tells us our username is WebUser, but at no point does the page display any authorization information that a hacker could capture and decode. This is secure in that Digest does not send the password information over the HTTP connection. You now know that Digest is a complex way to authenticate a user. However, you also have a good feel for how it works and the steps required to set it up. Remember that this is different from Advanced Digest. Digest is supported on IIS 5 and 6, while Advanced is only available on IIS 6. Now we'll take a look at Windows Integrated Authentication. IT pros have frequently told us that they are not sure what they're enabling when they click the Integrated Windows checkbox in the IIS Manager Authentication Methods property sheet. So let's get into what it is here. Windows Integrated Authentication is really a combination of three authentication types. The first is Negotiate, which serves as a wrapper, if you will, for the other two types. One is Kerberos, and the second type is NTLM, which stands for NT LAN Manager, and is an older authentication mechanism. We'll go a little into the details of each of these in a few moments. But first, let's talk about how Negotiate works and the general process of authenticating a client request. First, we have an incoming request for a resource on your site or application. Typically, the user is not prompted initially for a username and password, and the current Windows user information is passed by Internet Explorer as a hashed value to IIS. Only if authentication fails using this Windows information does Internet Explorer prompt the user for a username and password. So when this request with these credentials arrives, Negotiate takes the incoming request and passes it first to the Kerberos protocol. If Active Directory is installed on a domain controller running Windows Server 2003 and the browser supports Kerberos, Negotiate will choose Kerberos on the first attempt. If one of these conditions is not met, however, Negotiate will use NTLM. You have other options, however, than Negotiate. While Negotiate is the default setting for Windows Integrated Authentication, you can set the NT Authentication Providers property in the IIS60 metabase to NTLM to disable Kerberos. Let's go into detail on that last point and talk about configuring Windows Integrated Authentication. Our users only see the integrated Windows Authentication checkbox on the Authentication Methods property sheet and think that's the end of configuring Windows Integrated Authentication. By default, when you click this checkbox, the Negotiate protocol is enabled and the procedure we have just outlined goes through. But if you only want to support NTLM, you have an option. It's just not supported in the user interface. From the command line, you can edit the NT Authentication Providers property in the IIS6 metabase to contain the NTLM provider. To do this, you use the adsutil.vbs utility that is installed by default in the c:\inetpub/adminscripts folder. You use a set command, define the location, be it a site or a virtual directory, where you want to only use NTLM for authentication, enter NT Authentication Providers, and then NTLM. If you wanted to back this change out, you'd use the same command, but instead of NTLM, you'd enter Negotiate NTLM. We'll see how this works in just a few minutes in the next demo. Now that we know some configuration tricks, let's take a closer look at how Kerberos works. Using Kerberos requires several things, including your IIS6 server being a member of an Active Directory domain. Both the client on which the browser runs and the server must have access to a key distribution center, as well as a ticket granting service. So given that you have all of these set up, let's go through how this works when the browser sends a request to IIS. First, the browser client sends an anonymous request to the IIS60 server. The server responds with a 401 error code that contains a www-authenticate header that indicates negotiate. The browser client then sends a request to the KDC domain controller for a key to access the website or server for which it originally sent the request. If the web server is located in the domain with the KDC, the KDC sends the shared secret key to the client browser. With the key provided from the KDC, the browser creates a hashed key and sends it to IIS60. IIS takes the secret key provided by the browser and compares it to the key it shares across its domain with the KDC and verifies that the password matches. Now let's go over MTLM and see how it works. There are several things you should know about MTLM before we get going. First of all, the connection opened between the client and the server remains open until the request is resolved, whether successfully or unsuccessfully. To do that, you're required to use HTTP keepalives. Also, the domain and username are shared between the client and the server. However, the password is not. The password is always hashed and passed in the authentication header from the client to the server. Also, NTLM will not prompt the user for credentials unless the server first sends a 401.1 error code to the browser. So now that we have this background, let's look at what happens when a request arrives that does not have credentials yet. First, the browser will send the IIS server a request for a page or resource, default.htm, for example. The server will then send a 401 error to the browser that contains a www-authenticate header that lets the browser know that NTLM is enabled for the requested default.htm. The browser will send a second request for the default.htm file with the NTLM authentication header that contains its username. IIS60 then uses that authentication header to build a secret key and sends the browser another 401 error code with the www-authenticate header that contains that key. Let's quickly look at the last couple of steps. The client then sends the request for the default.htm page again, this time with an NTLM authentication header that contains the username and a hash of the password based on the secret key it received from IIS. The strength of NTLM is that the hash algorithm used to create this password isn't visible over the HTTP connection used for the request, so it's difficult to break. IIS then checks that the username and password hash match. If they do, it returns a 200 OK message and the requested content to the browser. If they don't, IIS sends a 401.1 authentication failed message to the browser. This is when Internet Explorer will prompt the user for credentials. Now that we understand better how Kerberos and NTLM work, let's take a look at some of the limitations of Windows Integrated Authentication. Our first limitation is that you can't force Windows Integrated to only use Kerberos, even though it's a more secure form of authentication than NTLM. Second, Kerberos requires that both the client and server have a trusted connection to the key distribution center and Active Directory. This isn't something that you want to do in an internet environment at all. You would be exposing your domain to too much of a security risk. That said, Kerberos is fine by choice for corporate domains or any other system that is protected from the rest of the internet by a firewall. NTLM is not supported by most proxies. In fact, it relies on having a single HTTP connection between the browser and IIS while the authentication request is being processed. In many cases, proxies break the connection, which will cause NTLM to fail. Because of these limitations, Windows Integrated is best suited for intranet uses rather than situations in which your application is exposed to the entire internet. NTLM can work well in an internet situation where you're using secure sockets layer, but you'd have to pick and choose how and when to use that, and there might be simpler solutions that work just as well with SSL. That's for you to decide. Troubleshooting can be difficult when you're using Windows Integrated. We recommend that you use the AuthDiag tool that is part of the IIS Diagnostics Toolkit. However, you can start by asking yourself a few basic questions. For Kerberos, the first question to ask is whether the Key Distribution Center, or KDC, is available to both the client and the server. If there is a proxy or firewall between the KDC and either the server or the client, then Kerberos could fail. Also, you should ask whether the service principal name, or SPN, is registered correctly. This is a common problem in IIS 6 when you set the app identity property to a domain account. SPN registration can break for Kerberos. This is because you need to set the SPN identity to the host. For NTLM, you should make sure to double check that HTTP keeper lives are enabled for your site. This is because of the requirement of the NTLM protocol that we mentioned earlier. NTLM needs the same connection open to the client for its authentication check to complete. If we don't have keeper lives enabled, and we don't maintain that connection, NTLM considers the credentials it's getting to be falsified and it will break off its authentication process. But we have a demo here that should help you make that determination. We're going to look at a simple .asp page that will display the authentication types associated with the incoming request. This is an easy way to determine whether Kerberos is working or whether NTLM is performing authentication on any given request. What we'll do first is go into IIS Manager and reconfigure our default website to use Windows Integrated Authentication. One thing to keep in mind is that you need to perform these steps on a domain controller. You won't be able to set this up if you aren't working on one. That's a little bit of overhead if you have a small website. Once we get to the authentication methods page, we disable anonymous access, and then we enable Windows Integrated. Remember to double check any other authentication methods you may have enabled too, and disable them if you need to. Then we'll click OK, click OK again, and there you have it. We've enabled Windows Integrated Authentication. Let's test this. We have a variables.aspx page that returns the server variables associated with the request. It's a simple page. It just spits out the key value pairs that you find in the request.serverVariables property in ASP.NET. A page like this can be handy for troubleshooting authentication in your sites, so you should keep this technique in mind. Now we have the page and we're interested in a few things. First, the auth type is negotiate, which we knew it would be. Then the values associated with the auth user and logon user keys are the same. They're both the Windows account name that made the request. If we had a logon password enabled for the administrator, we'd get a value there too, but it's blank in this case. Let's also look at the HTTP authorization header value. This is what is going to give us a solid clue about whether Windows is using Kerberos or NTLM to authenticate the request. We'll see here that we have a big value, but there's no way to know for sure that IIS is using Kerberos. The request header doesn't just come out and say it, so you have to make an educated guess about whether negotiated using Kerberos or not. But let's compare what that header looks like when we use NTLM. We can force IIS to use NTLM, so let's go ahead and do that. We start out by opening a command prompt window and going to inetpub admin scripts. We are going to use a tool you should all know well by this time in our presentation, ADS util. We mentioned this metabase property earlier, NT authentication providers, and we set it to NTLM. If you want to return this property setting to negotiate, redo this command, but set the property value to negotiate, NTLM. Now that we've set NT authentication providers, we return to IIS and browse to our variables.aspx file. Now we scroll down to the HTTP authorization key and we find the value is NTLM. This is a lot more straightforward. This ambiguity about negotiate occurs because of limitations in Internet Explorer. It doesn't recognize Kerberos as a valid HTTP authorization header value. Let's move on to our next authentication type, Microsoft Passport. The next type of authentication supported by IIS 6 is Microsoft Passport. This authentication type is only available on IIS 6.0, so if you're running other versions of IIS, this isn't supported. However, ASP.NET 1.1 did support Passport authentication, but that was done separately from IIS 5.0 and 5.1. You can enable it in the IIS Manager, but it takes a fair amount of effort to set up. Passport also uses a secure central database that is owned by Microsoft and is designed to create a single sign-on solution for a number of different environments across the internet. After Passport has issued an authentication token, you can delegate that token to other sites. Also, Passport encrypts all credentials before it sends them across an open HTTP connection. There are a number of requirements you must support for your IIS6 server to run Passport. These include secure sockets layer, cookies, HTTP redirects, and Microsoft JScript. If you don't have these running in your environment, you will have problems using Passport. The actual transfer of data in Passport is different from other authentication types, so let's take a look at how that works. Here is what happens when a request arrives at your IIS60 server that's enabled for Passport. The browser sends the request, of course. The next step is, just like with all of the other authentication types, IIS sends a 401 response that tells your browser what authentication types it supports. In this case, it would include Passport. Now here is where we get into something a little different. The browser communicates directly with the Passport servers and obtains the necessary cookie from Passport to indicate that the user is authenticated. The browser then sends a request to the IIS6 server with the cookie. IIS will return a 200 code or success. Now your IIS server can pass this cookie along to other sites as well, reducing the overall times the authentication process must be repeated. Now, as mentioned earlier, it takes a lot to set up the infrastructure that will make Passport work. You're going to have to write some code to get it to work, and you'll also have to do some work to get your site provisioned on the Passport servers. You need to know that so you can make decisions about whether you want to use this technology. That time hit can be a decision factor. We'll outline several resources you can access on how to do those steps later in our presentation. Let's step back for a second and take a look at our agenda. Our next discussion will be about ASP.NET Forms authentication. We'll show you how Forms authentication works on an incoming request, and we'll include a demonstration on configuring Forms authentication using the ASP.NET MMC snap-in. Then we'll show you what happens when a user fills in the login form and submits it to the ASP.NET application. So let's move forward and dive into that. ASP.NET Forms authentication enables you to authenticate the username and password of your users using a web-based logon form that you create. Rather than the Windows dialog box appearing for users to enter their credentials, unauthenticated requests are directed to a logon page where the user provides credentials and submits the form. If the application authenticates the request, the system issues a ticket that contains a key used to re-establish the identity for later requests. We can enable Forms authentication for an entire ASP.NET site or an ASP.NET application which resides at the IIS 6.0 virtual directory level. You can enable ASP.NET 2.0 Forms authentication through the ASP.NET configuration files. You'll typically do this in the web.config file that is associated with your site or application. The easiest way to perform this configuration is through the ASP.NET MMC snap-in that you can access through the IIS site or virtual directory properties window. We'll cover this in our demo in just a few minutes. If you want to allow your users to only enter their credentials periodically, the ASP.NET application or site can send a cookie that contains the authentication ticket to the browser after the user has been authenticated. When the user returns to your site or application after being authenticated, ASP.NET checks for this cookie and uses the information stored in it to authenticate the user without having him or her enter her credentials again. This is typically a decision a developer would make, but IT pros should be aware that this can be done. Now, Forms authentication is not secure by itself. When the user submits credentials, they're transmitted over the HTTP connection between the browser and server. While your developers can use encryption formats, SHA-1 and MD5 are the most common, to encode the user credentials, this only happens on the server side, and the credentials are sent as clear text over the open connection. So you'll always want to use Forms authentication with Secure Sockets layer to transport those credentials across the wire. ASP.NET version 2.0 offers a new way to store your users, known as membership. In previous versions of ASP.NET, users and their information was typically stored to Microsoft Active Directory or to a Microsoft SQL Server database. With version 2.0, however, ASP.NET has a built-in mechanism to manage your application's users and their secure information. We won't discuss this here, but wanted to bring this to your attention so that you know how the ASP.NET applications you're managing and enabling Forms authentication for work. Now that we've given you an overview of ASP.NET Forms authentication, let's dig into how it works. So, when we're using ASP.NET Forms authentication, IIS is involved, but only so far as it is involved in any ASP.NET request. IIS simply checks the extension of the file requested in the HTTP request, and when it finds it's mapped to a .aspx file, it forwards the request to the ASP.NET IIS API to complete the processing. IIS has nothing to do with performing any authentication steps in this scenario. It's all left to ASP.NET. So how then does ASP.NET handle a request for a page that is protected by Forms authentication? Let's walk through that now. The first step is that a browser requests a protected resource, a default.aspx file, for example, from the IIS web server. If the request does not contain an authentication cookie, ASP.NET redirects the request to a logon page that the application will use to collect the user's username and password. The name of the default.aspx page is passed on in the redirect query string as a return URL attribute value. One thing to note here is that unless you've enabled Secure Sockets layer for your logon page, any username and password that the user inputs will be passed over the HTTP connection as clear text. So to make Forms authentication completely secure, you need to use SSL with it. The next step is that the user enters his or her credentials in the logon.aspx page and submits them. ASP.NET validates the credentials, and if the user is authenticated, ASP.NET redirects the browser to the default.aspx page that was originally requested. ASP.NET also issues an authentication token to the browser, either in the form of a cookie or in the URL, depending on how the application is programmed. The browser then follows the redirection to the default.aspx page. If you end up having been issued an authentication ticket as a cookie, the next time the browser visits this site or application, ASP.NET will inspect the cookie rather than require the user to resubmit his or her username and password. This will work until the cookie expires. So now that we have a good idea of how Forms authentication works in ASP.NET, let's take a look at how to configure it and see it in action. In this demo, we'll configure an application with the ASP.NET MMC snap-in to enable it to perform Forms authentication and do a quick check of the application. Configure Forms authentication with the ASP.NET MMC snap-in. Now that the script has run, let's go into IIS Manager and make sure everything is working properly. The site is there and running, and the default website is stopped. Before we do any configuration, let's just browse to the default page. It takes just a second for ASP.NET to run through the first time request, and then the content appears with a bold header, a hello, and a sign out button. Let's go ahead and open the properties sheet for our site, and then go to the ASP.NET tab. We'll see that version 2.0 is in use here. Everything looks good so far. We can start setting up forms authentication now. We'll start by going into authorization and adding a deny rule. Then we'll click anonymous users and then click OK. Now, what we've done for our site here is tell it that it does not accept incoming requests from anonymous users. From now on, it will only allow users to access the site who supply their username and password. Now that we have the authorization part configured, let's move on to the authentication section. We can change the authentication mode from Windows to Forms. We also want to define the path to the logon page, which, in this case, is already defined. Then we'll go ahead and click OK. We will ignore membership and roles for now. There are other demonstrations that go into more detail on how to use this ASP.NET 2.0 functionality, so if you want to learn more, links to presentations on that will be included later. So what happens when we refresh the page we just opened? Remember, we stored the configuration to a file, and now ASP.NET is picking it up. So instead of getting defaults.aspx, we are redirected to the new logon form asking for a username and password. After we enter the email address and password and click login, we're authenticated and back to the defaults.aspx page. This page grabs the username we entered and displays it as text. Using the ASP.NET configuration user interface makes this task a lot easier. In previous versions of ASP.NET, you'd have to write XML into the web.config file for your site, and you'd need to make sure you didn't introduce any mistakes into the configuration file. But we were able to do all this without looking at any XML. The other nice thing about ASP.NET configuration is that once you've performed these steps, you can simply x-copy the web.config files to other IIS servers to deploy the configuration changes. Now we'll quickly summarise what we've gone over today. In this session, we talked about the difference between authentication and authorization and touched on a wide number of authentication approaches you can use to meet your web application's needs on IIS 6.0. Our discussion included Anonymous, Basic, Digest, Windows Integrated, and Passport Authentication, and we talked about the pluses and minuses of each, including ease of configuration and requirements. We also included demonstrations on how to configure these and the authentication methods that you can set up on your server. We also discussed the amount of work it takes to provision Microsoft Passport Authentication. We reviewed the IIS sub-authentication and how it can be a key element of anonymous access and is, in fact, required for Digest authentication. We looked at a demonstration that showed you how to enable sub-authentication and then showed you a request that used sub-authentication. We also told you that Basic and ASP.NET Forms authentication methods required SSL to secure user credentials over the HTTP connection between the client and the server. Finally, we went over ASP.NET Forms authentication and touched on this additional option for ASP.NET applications. We showed you a demo of how to configure Forms authentication using the ASP.NET MMC snap-in and then performed a request that used it. For the most comprehensive technical information on Microsoft products, visit the TechNet website at www.microsoft.com/technet. You can also visit www.microsoft.com/technet/add-21 for more information on books, courses, certifications, and other community resources that relate directly to this particular session. There are a number of other resources that are available from Microsoft. There are a couple of good books from Microsoft Press that might help you. The first is the Microsoft IIS 6.0 Administrator's Pocket Consultant, and the second is the Microsoft Internet Information Services 6.0 Resource Kit. Microsoft also has instructor-led courses if you prefer the classroom-style environment. Microsoft Learning develops courseware called Microsoft Official Curriculum, which includes e-learning, Microsoft Pressbooks, workshops, clinics, and Microsoft Skills Assessment. MOC is offered in instructor-led environments. It offers comprehensive training courses for IT professionals in supporting and implementing solutions using Microsoft products and technologies. The course that best supports this session is Microsoft Security Guidance Training 2 Clinic, which is available as an online course now. This course dedicates a module to security methods you can take in IIS 6, including authentication methods. This clinic will provide you with a broad background to help you secure servers across your network, not just your web applications. For more information, please visit www.microsoft.com/learning. There is also an assessment program available that can help you test your knowledge. Microsoft Skills Assessment is a free online learning tool. It's an easy way for IT professionals to check their skills. You can quickly check your skills in implementing or managing Microsoft products or business solutions. Just take a short 30-question assessment and see how well you know your stuff. The Skills Assessment includes a personalized learning plan, which includes links to Microsoft Official Curriculum, specific TechNet articles, Microsoft Pressbooks, and other Microsoft Learning content. There's also a way to measure how well you did compared with others who took the same assessment. Microsoft Skills Assessment is an expanding learning platform. Available now are assessments for Windows Server 2003, including security and patch management, Exchange Server 2003, Windows Storage Server, Office 2003, and VisualStudio.net. If you want to take your skills assessment to the next level, a number of certification programs are available. In the highly competitive IT job market, how can you set yourself apart from the next candidate? The Microsoft certification program provides that edge. Earning a specific accreditation provides objective validation of the ability to successfully perform critical IT functions. Embraced by industry professionals worldwide, Microsoft certification remains one of the most effective ways to reach long-term career goals and is a surefire way for companies to develop and retain valuable IT staff. Several accreditations are available, starting with the basic Microsoft Certified Professional. You can become a fully certified system administrator, system engineer, or a desktop specialist. Away from the infrastructure side, the MCDBA certification covers the SQL Server products. For more information about the certification program, visit www.microsoft.com/learning/MCP. This session was brought to you by TechNet. TechNet has gone through some changes recently, which you might find interesting. To help explain this in more detail, here's Ian Brackenbury, TechNet Subscriptions Product Manager.
TechNet Plus Subscription introduces its newest offering, TechNet Plus Direct. With TechNet Plus Direct, subscribers get all of the benefits of TechNet Plus for 30% less. Subscribers receive fast, easy access to the tools and information they need to get the most out of Microsoft solutions. A subscription provides IT professionals with immediate online access to all the essential technical resources they need to resolve technical issues faster, get hands-on experience with the latest Microsoft technologies, and build technical skills. Subscribers now get immediate access to all their subscription features in one convenient location, our new online benefits portal. Subscribers get access through subscriber download to Microsoft full version software for evaluation and beta releases without time or feature limits. No more waiting for media shipments. This includes Microsoft Server, client, and application software titles. With full version software, subscribers can make informed decisions about new technologies and deployments at their own pace. For the toughest technical questions, a TechNet Plus subscription also comes with two complimentary professional support incidents. Subscribers can talk to a Microsoft support professional to quickly resolve their mission-critical technical issues fast. TechNet Plus also provides access to over 100 managed newsgroups. Subscribers can exchange ideas with other professionals and get expert answers to their technical questions within the next business day, guaranteed. In addition, subscribers can also chat with a Microsoft Search Assistant online for help finding the technical resources they need or for assistance with non-technical questions. Subscribers also get access to technical information and tools, including the TechNet Plus library containing the knowledge base, security updates, service packs, resource kits, and more. TechNet Plus offers proven value that far exceeds its cost. The two complimentary professional support incidents alone more than offset the cost of a TechNet Plus subscription. Add to that the evaluation and beta software and other technical resources, and TechNet Plus clearly boosts productivity. Every IT professional on the team needs one. TechNet Plus is available exclusively online without media shipments. For more information, please visit technet.microsoft.com/subscriptions. There are a number of free community resources available on TechNet. You can attend a regular chat with members of the product groups or technology specialists from Microsoft, or you can attend a webcast where you can see sessions like the one you've just watched, but presented live and with the ability to ask questions as you go. You can also read or post questions in public newsgroups. The newsgroup page lists the available groups and provides an interface from which you can read and post messages. TechNet Plus subscribers can use these groups to post questions and, through their subscription ID, are guaranteed a response from Microsoft support professionals and IT experts by the next business day. The main community site provides a comprehensive list of resources available, more than we can cover on this slide, and the page has some dynamic features with continually updated content. The events page provides dates and details about attending a live TechNet event. These events take place around the world and provide the opportunity for you to talk to Microsoft specialists face-to-face. And finally, the TechNet columns provide a variety of topics written by industry authors. And with that, thank you for taking the time to listen to this TechNet session.